Part 3. Julian returned from Humboldt with a friend who wanted a ride to L.A. The friend's name was Zav. It seemed vaguely Rastafarian how he pronounced it. Though Zav was fishy white, with a bog of orange hair held back by a woman's elastic. He was much older than Julian, maybe 35, but dressed like an adolescent. The same too long cargo shorts, the t-shirt worn to a pulp. He walked around Dan's house with an appraising squint, picking up a figurine of an ox carved from bone or ivory, then putting it down. He peered at a photo of Julian in his mother's arms on the beach, then replaced the frame on the shelf, chuckling to himself.
"It's cool if he stays here tonight, right?"
Julian asked, as if I were the den mother.
"It's your house."
Zav came over to shake my hand.
"Thanks," he said, pumping away. "That's real decent of you."
Sasha and Zav seemed to know each other, and soon all three were talking about a gloomy bar near Humboldt, owned by a gray-haired grower. Julian had his arm around Sasha, with the adult air of a man returning from the mines. It was hard to imagine him harming a dog, or harming anyone. Sasha so obviously pleased to be near him. She'd been girlish and veiled with me all day, no hint of our conversation the night before. Zav said something that made her laugh, a pretty, subdued laugh, half covering her mouth, like she didn't want to expose her teeth. I'd planned to walk to town for dinner, leave them alone, but Julian noticed me heading for the door.
"Hey, hey, hey," he said.
They all turned to look at me.
"I'm gonna go into town for a bit," I said.
"You should eat with us," Julian said.
Sasha nodded, scooting into his side, giving me the sloppy half-attention of someone in the orbit of her beloved.
"We got a bunch of food," she said.
I made the usual smiling excuses, but finally I took off my jacket, already getting used to attention. They'd stopped for groceries on the way back from Humboldt, a giant frozen pizza, some discount ground beef in a styrofoam tray.
"A feast," Zav said. "You've got your protein, your calcium."
He pulled a pill bottle from his pocket.
"Your vegetables."
He started rolling a joint on the table, a process that involved multiple papers and much fussing over the construction. Zav eyed his work from a distance, then pinched a little more from the pill bottle, the room marinating in the stench of damp weed. Julian was cooking the beef on the stove, the meat losing its sheen. He poked at the crude patties with a butter knife, prodding and sniffing. Dorm room cookery. Sasha slid the pizza in the oven, balling up the plastic wrap, setting out paper towels at each chair, a suburban memory of chores, of setting the table for dinner. Zav drank a beer and watched Sasha with amused contempt. He hadn't lit the joint yet, though he twirled it in his fingers with obvious pleasure. I listened while he and Julian talked about drugs with the intensity of professionals, exchanging stats like bond traders. Greenhouse yield versus sun-grown. Comparing THC levels in varying strains. This was nothing like the hobby drugs of my youth, pot-grown alongside tomato plants, passed around in mason jars. You could pick out seeds from a bud and plant them yourself if you felt like it. Trade a lid for enough gas to get to the city. It was strange to hear drugs flattened to a matter of numbers, a knowable commodity instead of a mystic portal. Maybe Zav and Julian's way was better, cutting out all the woozy idealism.
"Fuck," Julian said. The kitchen smelled of ashes and burning starch. "Damn, damn, damn."
He opened the oven and pulled the pizza out with his bare hands, swearing as he tossed it on the counter. It was black and smoky.
"Man," Zav said, "that was the good kind, too. Expensive." Sasha was frantic, hurrying over to consult the back of the pizza box.
"Preheat to 450," she droned. "I did that. I don't understand."
"What time did you put it in?" Zav asked. Sasha's eyes moved to the clock.
"The clock's frozen, idiot," Julian said. He grabbed the box and stuffed it in the garbage. Sasha looked like she might cry.
"Whatever," he said with disgust, picking at the burnt shell of cheese, then rubbing his fingers clean. I thought of the professor's dog. The poor animal, limping in circles, vascular system slushy with poison. All the other things Sasha had probably not told me.
"I can make something else," I said. "There's some pasta in the cabinet." I tried to catch Sasha's eye, willing some combination of warning and sympathy to pass from me to her. But Sasha was unreachable, stung by her failure. The room got quiet, Zav fussing the joint between his fingers, waiting to see what would happen.
"There's a lot of beef, I guess," Julian said, finally, his anger slipping from sight.
"No big thing."
He rubbed Sasha's back, roughly, I thought, though the movement seemed to comfort her, returning her to the world. When he kissed her, she closed her eyes. We drank a bottle of Dan's wine at dinner, the sediment settling in the cracks of Julian's teeth. Beer after that. Alcohol cut the fat on our breath. I didn't know what time it was. The windows black, the squeeze of wind through the eaves. Sasha was corralling wet pieces of the wine label into a meticulous pile. I could feel her glance at me from time to time, Julian's hand working the back of her neck. He and Zav maintained a constant patter all through dinner, Sasha and I fading into a silence familiar from adolescence. The effort to break through Zav and Julian's alliance wasn't worth the return. It was simpler to watch them, to watch Sasha, who acted like just sitting there was enough.
"'Cause you're a good guy," Zav kept saying. "You're a good guy, Julian, and that's why I don't make you pay up front with me. You know I have to do that with McGinley, Sam, all those retards."
They were drunk, the three of them, and maybe I was too. The ceiling drab with expired smoke. We'd shared a burly joint, a sexual droop descending on Zav, a pleased, overcome squint. Sasha had drawn further into herself, though she'd unzipped her sweatshirt, her chest sunless and crossed with faint blue veins. Her eye makeup was heavier than it had been. I didn't know when she'd put more on. I got to my feet when we finished eating. "I've got to do a few things," I said. They made half-hearted efforts to get me to stay, but I waved them off. I closed the door to the bedroom, though bits of their conversation slipped through.
"I respect you," Julian was saying to Zav. "I always have, man. Ever since Scarlet was like, you have to meet this guy."
Performing an extravagant admiration, the stoned person's tendency toward optimistic summary. Zav responded, resuming their practiced volley. I could hear Sasha's silence. When I passed through later, nothing had really changed. Sasha was still listening to their conversation, like she'd be tested someday. Julian and Zav's intoxication had passed into a strenuous state, their hairlines wet with sweat.
"Are we being too loud?" Julian asked.
That weird politeness again. How easily it clicked in.
"Not at all," I said.
"Just getting some water."
"Sit with us," Zav said, studying me. "Talk."
"That's okay."
"Come on, Evie,"
Julian said. The odd intimacy of my name in his mouth surprised me. The table was stamped with rings from the bottles, the litter of dinner. I started to clear the dishes.
"You don't have to do that," Julian said, scooting back so I could reach his plate.
"You cooked," I said. Sasha made a peep of thanks when I added her plate to the stack. Zav's phone lit up, shivering across the surface of the table. Someone was calling. A blurry photograph of a woman in underwear flashed on the screen.
"Is that Lexi?"
Julian asked. Zav nodded, ignoring the call. A look passed between Julian and Zav. I didn't want to notice it. Zav belched. They both laughed. I could smell the memory of chewed meat.
"Benny is doing computer shit now," Zav said. "You know that?"
Julian hit the table.
"No fucking way."
I walked the dishes to the sink, gathering the balled paper towels from the counter, sweeping crumbs into my hand.
"He's fat as fuck," Zav said. "It's hilarious."
"Is Benny the guy from your high school?" Sasha asked.
Julian nodded. I let the sink fill with water. Watching Julian swivel his body to mirror Sasha's, knocking his knees into hers, he kissed her on the temple.
"You guys are too fucking much," Zav said.
His tone had a tricky bite. I sank the dishes in the water. A scummy network of grease formed on the surface.
"I just don't get it," Zav went on, addressing Sasha. "Why you stay with Julian? You're too hot for him."
Sasha giggled, though I glanced back and saw her labor to calculate a response.
"I mean, she's a babe," Zav said to Julian. "Am I right?"
Julian smiled what I thought of as the smile of an only son, someone who believed he would always get what he wanted. He probably always had. The three of them were lit like a scene from a movie I was too old to watch.
"But Sasha and I know each other, don't we?"
Zav smiled at her.
"I like Sasha."
Sasha held a basic smile on her face, her fingers tidying the pile of torn label.
"She doesn't like her tits,"
Julian said, pulsing the back of her neck.
"But I tell her they're nice." "Sasha," Zav affected upset. "You have great tits."
I flushed, hurrying to finish the dishes.
"Yeah,"
Julian said, his hand still on her neck.
"Zav would tell you if you didn't." "I always tell the truth," Zav said. "He does," Julian said. "That's true."
"Show me," Zav said.
"They're too small," Sasha said.
Her mouth was tight, like she was making fun of herself, and she shifted in her seat.
"They'll never sag, so that's good," Julian said,
tickling her shoulder.
"Let Zav see."
Sasha's face reddened.
"Do it, babe,"
Julian said, a harshness in his voice making me glance over. I caught Sasha's eye. I told myself the look in her face was pleading.
"Come on, you guys," I said.
The boys turned with amused surprise, though I think they were tracking where I was all along, that my presence was a part of the game.
"What?"
Julian said, his face snapping into innocence.
"Just cool it," I told him. "Oh, it's fine," Sasha said,
laughing a little, her eyes on Julian.
"What exactly are we doing?" Julian said. "What exactly should we cool?"
He and Zav snorted. How quickly all the old feelings came back. The humiliating interior fumble. I crossed my arms, looking to Sasha.
"You're bothering her."
"Sasha's fine," Julian said.
He tucked a strand of her hair behind her ear. She smiled faintly and with effort.
"Besides," he went on, "are you really someone who should be lecturing us?"
My heart tightened.
"Didn't you, like, kill someone?" Julian said.
Zav sucked his teeth, then let loose a nervous laugh. My voice sounded strangled.
"Of course not." "But you knew what they were going to do,"
Julian said, grinning with the thrill of capture.
"You were there, with Russell Hadrick and shit."
"Hadrick?"
Zav said. "Are you shitting me?"
I tried to rein in the hysterical lean coming into my voice.
"I was barely around." Julian shrugged. That's not what it sounded like.
You don't really believe that. But there was no entry point in any of their faces.
Sasha said you told her so, Julian went on. Like you could have done it too.
I inhaled sharply. The pathetic betrayal. Sasha had told Julian everything I'd said.
So show us, Zav said, turning back to Sasha.
I was already invisible again.
Show us the famous tits.
You don't have to, I said to her. Sasha flicked her eyes in my direction.
It isn't a big deal or anything, she said,
her tone dripping with cool, obvious disdain. She plucked her neckline away from her chest and looked pensively down her shirt.
See, Julian said, smiling hard at me. Listen to Sasha.
I had gone to one of Julian's recitals when Dan and I were still close. Julian must have been 9 years old or so. He was good at the cello, I remembered, his tiny arms going about their mournful adult work. His nostrils rimmed with snot, the instrument in careful balance. It didn't seem possible that the boy who had called forth those sounds of longing and beauty was the same almost man who watched Sasha now, a cold varnish on his eyes. She pulled her shirt down, her face flushed, but mostly dreamy. The impatient, professional tug she gave when the neckline caught on her bra. Then both pale breasts were exposed, her skin marked by the line of her bra. Zav exclaimed approvingly, reaching to thumb a rosy nipple while Julian looked on. I had long outlived whatever usefulness I had here.
1969.
11. I got caught. Of course I did. Mrs. Dutton on her kitchen floor calling my name like a right answer. And I hesitated for just a moment, a stunned, bovine reaction to my own name, the knowledge that I should help the fallen Mrs. Dutton. But Suzanne and Donna were far ahead, and by the time I jarred back into that realization, they had almost disappeared. Suzanne turned back, just long enough to see Mrs. Dutton clamp a trembling hand on my arm. My mother's pained and baffled declarations. I was a failure. I was pathological. She wore the air of crisis like a flattering new coat. The stream of her anger performed for an invisible jury. She wanted to know who had broken into the Dutton house with me.
Judy saw two girls with you, she said. Maybe three. Who were they?
Nobody. I tended my rigid silence like a suitor, full of honorable feelings. Before she and Donna disappeared, I tried to flash Suzanne a message. I would take responsibility. She didn't have to worry. I understood why they'd left me behind. It was just me, I said. Anger made her words garbled. You can't stay in this house and spout lies. I could see how rattled she was by this confusing new situation. Her daughter had never been a problem before, had always zipped along without resistance, as tidy and self-contained as those fish that clean their own tanks. And why would she bother to expect otherwise, or even prepare herself for the possibility?
You told me you were going to Connie's all summer, my mother said, almost shouting. You said it so many times, right to my face. And guess what? I called Arthur. He says you haven't been there in months, almost 2 months.
My mother looked like an animal then, her face made strange with rage. A gaspy run of tears.
You're a liar. You lied about that. You're lying about this, too.
Her hands were clenched hard. She kept lifting them, then dropping them at her sides.
I was seeing friends, I snapped. I have other friends besides Connie. Other friends?
Sure. You're out screwing some boyfriend, God knows what. Nasty little liar.
She was barely looking at me, her words as compulsive and fevered as the muttered obscenities of a pervert.
Maybe I should take you down to the juvenile detention center. Is that what you want? It's clear to me I just can't control you anymore. I'll let them have you. See if they can straighten you out.
I wrenched away. But even in the hallway, even with my door closed, I could still hear my mother at her bitter chant. Frank was called in as reinforcement. I watched from the bed as he took my bedroom door off its hinges. He was careful and quiet, though it took him a while, and he eased the door out of the frame as if it were made of glass instead of cheapo hollow core. He placed it against the wall gently, then hovered for a moment in the now empty doorway, rattling the screws in his hands like dice.
"Sorry about this," he said, like he was just the hired help, the maintenance man, carrying out my mother's wishes.
I didn't want to have to notice the actual kindness in his eyes, how immediately it drained my hateful narration of Frank of any real heat. I could picture him in Mexico for the first time, slightly sunburned so the hair on his arm turned platinum, sipping a lemon soda while overseeing his gold mine. I pictured a cave whose interior was cobblestoned in stony growths of gold. I kept expecting Frank to tell my mother about the stolen money, pile on more problems to the list. But he didn't. Maybe he'd seen that she was already angry enough. Frank kept up a silent vigil at the table during her many phone calls with my father while I listened from the hallway. Her high-pitched complaints, all her questions squeezed to a panicked register. What kind of person breaks into a neighbor's house? A family I'd known my whole life.
For no reason, she added shrilly. A pause. You think I haven't asked her? You think I haven't tried?
Silence.
Oh, sure, right, I bet. You want to try?
And so I was sent to Palo Alto. I spent 2 weeks at my father's apartment, across from a Denny's. The Portofino apartments as blocky and empty as my mother's house was sprawling and dense. Tamar and my father had moved into the biggest unit, and everywhere were the still lifes of adulthood she had so obviously arranged. A bowl of waxed fruit on the counter, the bar cart with its unopened bottles of liquor, the carpet that held the bland tracks of the vacuum. Suzanne would forget me, I thought. The ranch would hurtle on without me, and I'd have nothing. My sense of persecution gobbled up and grew fat off these worries. Suzanne was like a soldier's hometown sweetheart, made gauzy and perfect by distance. But maybe part of me was relieved to take some time away. The Dutton house had spooked me, the blank cast I'd seen in Suzanne's face. These were little bites, little inward shifts and discomforts, but even so, they were there. What had I expected living with my father and Tamar? That my father would try to sleuth out the source of my behavior? That he would punish me, act like a father? He seemed to feel punishment was a right he'd relinquished, and treated me with the courtly politeness you'd extend to an aging parent. He startled when he first saw me. It had been over 2 months. He seemed to remember that he should hug me, and made a lurching step in my direction. I noticed a new bunching at his ears, and his cowboy shirt was one I had never seen before. I knew I looked different, too. My hair was longer and wild at the edges, like Suzanne's. My ranch dress was so worn I could hook my thumb through the sleeve. My father made a move to help me with my bag, but I'd already hefted it into the back seat before he reached me. Thanks, though, I said, trying to smile. His hands spread at his sides, and when he smiled back, it was with the helpless apology of a foreigner who needed directions repeated. My brain, to him, was a mysterious magic trick that he could only wonder at. never bothering to puzzle out the hidden compartment. As we took our seats, I could sense that he was gathering himself to invoke the parental script.
"I don't have to lock you in your room, do I?" he said, his halting laugh. "No breaking in to anyone's house."
When I nodded, he visibly relaxed, like he'd gotten something out of the way.
"It's a good time for you to visit," he went on, as if this were all voluntary. "Now that we're settled, Tamar's real particular about the furniture and stuff."
He started the ignition, already beyond any mention of trouble.
"She went all the way to the flea market in Half Moon Bay to get this bar cart."
There was a brief moment I wanted to reach for him across the seat, to draw a line from myself to the man who was my father. But the moment passed.
"You can pick the station," he offered,
seeming as shy to me as a boy at a dance. The first few days, all three of us had been nervous. I got up early to make the bed in the guest room, trying to heft the decorative pillows back into completion. My life was limited to my drawstring purse and my duffel of clothes, an existence I tried to keep as neat and invisible as possible. Like camping, I thought, like a little adventure in self-reliance. The first night, my father brought home a cardboard tub of ice cream, striated with chocolate, and scooped free heroic amounts. Tamar and I just picked at ours, but my father made a point of eating another bowl. He kept glancing up, as if we could confirm his own pleasure. His women and his ice cream. Tamar was the surprise. Tamar in her terry shorts and shirt from a college I had never heard of, who waxed her legs in the bathroom with a complicated device that filled the apartment with the humidity of camphor. Her attendant unguents and hair oils, the fingernails whose lunar surfaces she studied for signs of nutritional deficiencies. At first, she seemed unhappy with my presence, the awkward hug she offered, like she was grimly accepting the task of being my new mother. And I was disappointed, too. She was just a girl, not the exotic woman I'd once imagined. Everything I thought was special about her was actually just proof of what Russell would call a straight world trip. Tamar did what she was supposed to, worked for my father, wore her little suit, aching to be someone's wife. But then her formality quickly melted away, the veil of adulthood she wore as temporarily as a costume. She let me rummage through the quilted pouch that held her makeup, her blousy perfume bottles, watching with the pride of a true collector. She pushed a blouse of hers with bell sleeves and pearl buttons onto me. "It's just not my style anymore," she shrugged, picking at a loose thread. "But it'll look good on you, I know. Elizabethan." And it did look good. Tamar knew those things. She knew the calorie count of most foods, which she recited in sarcastic tones, like she was making fun of her own knowledge. She cooked vegetable vindaloo, pots of lentils coated with a yellow sauce that gave off an unfamiliar brightness, the roll of powdery antacids my father swallowed like candy. Tamar held out her cheek for my father to kiss, but swatted him away when he tried to hold her hand. "You're all sweaty," she said. When my father saw that I had noticed, he laughed a little, but seemed embarrassed. My father was amused at our collusion, but it sometimes shook out, so we were laughing at him. Once Tamar and I were talking about Spanky and our gang, and he chimed in. "Like the little rascals," he figured. Tamar and I looked at each other. "It's a band," she said. "You know, that rock and roll music the kids like." And my father's confused, orphaned face set us off again. They had a fancy turntable that Tamar often spoke of moving to another corner or room for varying acoustic or aesthetic reasons. She constantly mentioned future plans for oak flooring and crown moldings and even different dish towels, though the planning itself seemed to satisfy. The music she played was more slick than the ranch racket. Jane Birkin, and her froggy old man husband, Serge.
"She's pretty," I said, studying the record cover. And she was. Tan as a nut with a delicate face. Those rabbit teeth.
Serge was disgusting. His songs about Sleeping Beauty. A girl who seemed most desirable because her eyes were always closed. Why would Jane love Serge?
Tamar loved my father. The girls loved Russell. These men who were nothing like the boys I'd been told I would like. Boys with hairless chests and mushy features. The flocking of blemishes along their shoulders. I didn't want to think of Mitch because it made me think of Suzanne. That night it happened somewhere else, in a little dollhouse in Tiburon with a tiny pool and a tiny green lawn. A dollhouse I could look onto from above, lifting the roof to see the rooms, segmented, like chambers of the heart. The bed, the size of a matchbox. Tamar was different from Suzanne in a way that was easier. She was not complicated. She didn't track my attention so closely, didn't prompt me to shore up her declarations. When she wanted me to move over, she said so. I relaxed, which was unfamiliar. Even so, I missed Suzanne. Suzanne, who I remembered like dreams of opening a door on a forgotten room. Tamar was sweet and kind, but the world she moved around in seemed like a television set, limited and straightforward and mundane, with the notations and structures of normality, breakfast, lunch, and dinner. There wasn't a frightening gap between the life she was living and the way she thought about that life. A dark ravine I often sensed in Suzanne, and maybe in my own self as well. Neither of us could fully participate in our days, though later Suzanne would participate in a way she could never take back. I mean that we didn't quite believe it was enough, what we were offered, and Tamar seemed to accept the world happily as an endpoint. Her planning wasn't actually about making anything different. She was just rearranging the same known quantities, puzzling out a new order, like life was an extended seating chart. Tamar made dinner while we waited for my father. She looked younger than usual, her face washed with the cleanser she had explained had actual milk proteins in it to prevent wrinkles. Her hair wet and darkening the shoulders of the big T-shirt she wore, her lace-edged cotton shorts. She belonged in a dorm room somewhere, eating popcorn and drinking beer.
"Hand me a bowl?"
I did, and Tamar set aside a portion of lentils.
"Without spices," she rolled her eyes, "for the tender heart's stomach."
I had a bitter flash of my mother doing that for my father. Little consolations, little adjustments, making the world mirror my father's wants. Buying him 10 pairs of the same socks so he never mismatched.
"It's almost like he's a kid sometimes, you know?"
Tamar said, pinching out a measure of turmeric.
"I left him for a weekend, and there was nothing to eat when I came back but beef jerky and an onion. He'd die if he had to take care of himself."
She looked at me.
"But I probably shouldn't tell you this, huh?"
Tamar wasn't being mean, but it surprised me, her ease in dismantling my father. It hadn't occurred to me before, not really, that he could be a figure of fun. Someone who could make mistakes, or act like a child, or stumble helplessly around the world, needing direction. Nothing terrible happened between me and my father. There was not a singular moment I could look back on, no shouting fight or slammed door. It was just the sense I got, a sense that seeped over everything until it seemed obvious that he was just a normal man, like any other. That he worried what other people thought of him, his eyes scatting to the mirror by the door. How he was still trying to teach himself French from a tape, and I heard him repeating words to himself under his breath. The way his belly, which was bigger than I remembered, sometimes showed through the gap in his shirts, exposing segments of skin, pink as a newborn's.
"And I love your father," Tamar said. Her words were careful, like she was being archived.
"I do.
He asked me to dinner 6 times before I said yes, but he was so nice about it. Like he knew I would say yes, even before I did."
She seemed to catch herself. Both of us were thinking it. My father had been living at home, sleeping in bed with my mother. Tamar flinched, obviously waiting for me to say as much, but I couldn't muster any anger.
That was the strange thing. I didn't hate my father. He had wanted something, like I wanted Suzanne, or my mother wanted Frank. You wanted things and you couldn't help it, because there was only your life, only yourself to wake up with. And how could you ever tell yourself what you wanted was wrong?
Tamar and I lay on the carpet, knees bent, heads angled toward the turntable. My mouth was still buzzing from the tartness of the orange juice we'd walked 4 blocks to buy from a stand. The wood heels of my sandals slapping the sidewalk. Tamar chatting happily in the warm summer dark. My father came in and smiled, but I could tell he was annoyed by the music, the way it skittered on purpose.
"Can you turn that down?" he asked.
"Come on," Tamar said. "It's not that loud."
"Yeah,"
I echoed, thrilled by the unfamiliarity of an ally.
"See,"
Tamar said. "Listen to your daughter." She reached blindly to pat at my shoulder. My father left without saying anything, then returned a minute later and lifted the needle. The room abruptly silent.
"Hey,"
Tamar said, sitting up. But he was already stalking away, and I heard the shower start in the bathroom.
"Fuck you,"
Tamar muttered. She got to her feet, the backs of her legs printed with the nub of the carpet, glancing at me.
"Sorry,"
she said, absently. I heard her talking in low tones in the kitchen. She was on the phone, and I watched her fingers piercing the loops of the cord over and over. Tamar laughed, covering her mouth as she did, cupping the receiver close. I had the uncomfortable certainty that she was laughing at my father. I don't know when I understood that Tamar would leave him. Not right away, but soon. Her mind was already somewhere else, writing a more interesting life for herself, one where my father and I would be the scenery to an anecdote, a detour from a larger, more correct journey, the redecoration of her own story. And who would my father have then to make money for, to bring dessert home to? I imagined him opening the door on an empty apartment after a long day at work. How the rooms would be as he'd left them, undisturbed by another person's living. And how there would be a moment before he flicked on the light, when he might imagine a different life revealed within the darkness. Something besides the lonely borders of the couch, the cushions still holding the shape of his own sleepy body. A lot of young people ran away. You could do it back then just because you were bored. You didn't even need a tragedy. Deciding to go back to the ranch wasn't difficult. My other house wasn't an option anymore, the ludicrous possibility of my mother dragging me to the police station. And what was there at my father's? Tamar, the way she insisted on my youthful alliance. The chocolate pudding after dinner, cold from the refrigerator, like our daily allotment of pleasure. Maybe before the ranch that life would have been enough. But the ranch proved that you could live at a rarer pitch, that you could push past these petty human frailties and into a greater love. I believed in the way of adolescence, in the absolute correctness and superiority of my love, my own feelings forming the definition. Love of that kind was something my father and even Tamar could never understand. And of course, I had to leave. While I had been watching television all day in the stuffy, overheated dark of my father's apartment, the ranch was going sour, though I wasn't aware to what degree until later. The problem was the record deal. It wasn't going to happen. And that was not something Russell could accept. His hands were tied, Mitch told Russell. He could not force the record company to change their minds. Mitch was a successful musician, a talented guitar player, but he did not have that kind of power. This was true. My night with Mitch seems piteous for that reason, a groundless whir of wheels. But Russell didn't believe Mitch, or it didn't matter anymore. Mitch became the convenient host for a universal sickness. The pacing rants that increased in frequency and length, Russell pinning it all on Mitch, that overfed Judas. The 22s, traded for bunt lines, the frenzy of betrayal Russell worked in the others. Russell wasn't even bothering to hide his anger anymore. Guy was bringing speed around, he and Suzanne running to the pump house, coming back with eyes black as berries. The target practice in the trees. The ranch had never been of the larger world, but it grew more isolated. No newspapers, no televisions, no radio. Russell began to turn away visitors and send Guy out with the girls on every garbage run. A shell hardening around the place. I can imagine Suzanne waking up those mornings with no sense of the days passing. The food situation getting dire, everything tinted with mild decay. They didn't eat much protein, their brains motoring on simple carbohydrates and the occasional peanut butter sandwich. The speed that scraped Suzanne of feeling. She must have moved through the filtery electricity of her own numbness, like moving through deep ocean. Everyone, later, would find it unbelievable that anyone involved in the ranch would stay in that situation. A situation so obviously bad. But Suzanne had nothing else. She had given her life completely over to Russell, and by then it was like a thing he could hold in his hands, turning it over and over, testing its weight. Suzanne and the other girls had stopped being able to make certain judgments, the unused muscle of their ego growing slack and useless. It had been so long since any of them had occupied a world where right and wrong existed in any real way. Whatever instincts they'd ever had, the weak twinge in the gut, a gnaw of concern, had become inaudible, if those instincts had ever been detectable at all. They didn't have very far to fall. I knew just being a girl in the world handicapped your ability to believe yourself. Feelings seemed completely unreliable, like faulty gibberish scraped from a Ouija board. My childhood visits to the family doctor were stressful events for that reason. He'd ask me gentle questions. How was I feeling? How would I describe the pain? Was it more sharp or more spread out? I just look at him with desperation. I needed to be told. That was the whole point of going to the doctor. To take a test, be put through a machine that could comb my insides with radiated precision and tell me what the truth was. Of course the girls didn't leave the ranch. There is a lot that can be borne. When I was 9, I'd broken my wrist falling from a swing. The shocking crack, the blackout pain. But even then, even with my wrist swelling with a cuff of trapped blood, I insisted I was fine, that it was nothing, and my parents believed me right up until the doctor showed them the X-ray. The bones snapped clean.